All year long, the Alabama Public Radio News team has been investigating the state's rural health care system. One issue is hospitals. 7 rural counties in Alabama currently don't have one, and one more county may be added to that list by the end of the month. John Paul Jones Hospital in Wilcox County says it will close after 60 years. 80% of the state's hospitals that are left are operating in the red, in part due to Medicare, which pays less in rural Alabama than almost anywhere else in the nation. APR's Pat Duggins reports one possible remedy for the state's rural hospital shortage is to think small.
I think people in the United States of America just don't realize that places like Perry County, Alabama, still exist.
If you want someone who's happy with rural health care in Alabama, don't ask Kendall Gilchrist.
We have actually lived in a third world country for a period of our lives, and there were more resources and more networks of support for us as a family in that third world country than there has been here.
In case you were wondering, which third world country?
The Dominican Republic.
Kendall, her husband Eric, and their 3 young children live in the town of Marion. The Gilchrists work at Judson College. On the subject of dealing with rural health care, Eric has an example from just last week.
My son falls out of bed in the middle of the night. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. And he wakes me up, and he has blood rushing down his face. And he had gashed the corner of his eye open, and there's blood, you know, all over his face. It's 2 o'clock in the morning in rural Alabama. What do you do?
Between them, the Gilchrists have 4 master's degrees and a PhD, but even that didn't help them get around the fact that Perry County doesn't have a hospital. The Alabama Rural Health Association says 6 other counties are in the same boat. When the only hospital in Wilcox County closes in a few weeks, residents in 8 Alabama counties could be asking questions like this one.
Do you drive an hour and a half one way to get some stitches? You may not even need stitches. Or do you just put a Band-Aid on it and wait it out and see what happens? We waited it out to see what would happen. And the next day he did need some glue. They glued it shut and it ended up being okay. But, you know, these are the sorts of decisions you're making at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Get down from there, don't fall.
Get down, D.
Just one county to the north, things seem less tense. Joseph Martian's big concern is making sure 2 boys don't fall off a 4-foot-tall stone wall outside the Bibb Medical Center. Martian is the CEO. This rural hospital in the town of Centerville in Bibb County is just 25 miles north of Marion, where the Gilchrists live, but it feels like a world away.
Good. The lab, you can see, it's centrally located right here.
Along with the hospital, Bibb Medical Center has a dental clinic and a nursing home. Martian says finances are tight, but it works.
Our system here is a little different because we're a little more unique than some because of the diversification that we have on our campus.
You know, rural hospitals have some secret sauce, and we can do things. We have to be lean because you can't stay in business if you're not.
Martian says his hospital isn't among the 80% in Alabama operating in the red. Still, Eric and Kendall Gilchrist prefer the specialists they can get in Birmingham, even though that means a 3-hour round trip. Bibb Medical Center has 35 hospital beds. Alabama will only certify hospitals with a minimum of 15, and Perry County, where the Gilchrists live, doesn't even have that.
Unfortunately, they have to have 15 in Alabama.
That's Dale Quinney. He's executive director of the Alabama Rural Health Association. He's looking for something in between the feast in Bibb County and the famine in Perry.
Well, there are some communities that perhaps can afford a hospital financially. Their patients will make it profitable that don't really need 15 beds.
That begs the question, how low can you go when it comes to the number of beds in a hospital?
We had 3.
That's Debbie Berry. She's director of operations at the Greene County Hospital in Leakesville, Mississippi. And you heard right. She said 3.
But when you think 3 beds, how in the world is that going to make it?
Dale Quinney says Leakesville does.
This hospital, 54 employees, 3 beds, and as we speak, it's expanding to 7 beds, is operating at a profit. So it can be done in the right location.
So we hit the road to have a look.
I'm Sarah Ulmer with what you need to know.
Leakesville is a 3-hour drive southwest of Tuscaloosa, or an hour northwest if you're coming from Mobile. Once on the campus of Greene County Hospital, we head through a sliding glass door and up to the reception desk.
Most of our equipment is refurbished or used, and I'm not too proud to beg.
That's where we met Debbie Berry. An automated lab unit processes blood samples from Greene County's patient load. Berry says there are a lot of samples to handle.
It went from them seeing maybe one or two a day when we came here. We're seeing around 350 now a month. So our numbers have just climbed tremendously, but we offer so much more now than we did.
What makes it all work? Joseph Marchant talked about the secret sauce at his hospital. The sauce at Debbie Berry's is what patients see when they walk in the door.
We're the first hospital in the state to have only nurse practitioners in their hospital. We don't have any doctors in our facility.
And it's that formula of fewer beds and no doctors that's the rub for regulators in Alabama.
I think it's a bit too simplistic.
That's Dr. Tom Geary with the Alabama Department of Public Health. He handles regulatory affairs, so he's familiar with how the business model of Leakesville's hospital will be received in Alabama.
It's more complex on the top of something that's already complicated.
Geary says the 15-bed minimum for rural hospitals in Alabama is due to state red tape. It means these facilities can expand in the future if they need to without a state relicensing process that can take years.
And so this is a compromise situation of making a difficult situation at least feasible for smaller hospitals to get at least 15 beds functioning.
And when it comes to areas like Perry County that have no hospital at all, Dr. Geary has an idea on that as well.
Number one would be to eliminate a lot of the rural hospitals, to utilize all of the land, the buildings, the services, the equipment, the personnel they have as a highly efficient outpatient urgent care center.
Urgent care centers treat people on the spot and either send them home or to bigger hospitals. On the subject of nurse practitioners doing the work of doctors, Geary says Alabama prefers physicians who directly supervise nurses, unlike what Leakesville does. Ironically, some of the staff at Greene County Hospital live in Mobile. They travel to Leakesville every day to practice the kind of medicine they can't do in Alabama. Which takes us back to the town of Marion and Judson College, which is one of the big employers in Perry County. The voices of its college choir are one of the few signs of hope in a situation that seems to be otherwise bleak.
It's hard for us to support each other because we're kind of just surviving.
For Kendall Gilchrist and her family, there's no clear sign that anything will get better here.
I think we don't even know how much it consumes our lives right now. And I think once we leave, it's only then that will start to kind of unpack this.
The Gilchrists are leaving Judson for a new life in a suburb of Washington, D.C. Leaders in Perry County are looking to bring some kind of hospital to fill the void. One option is a small operation called a critical access hospital with an emergency room and no more than 25 beds. Even if they succeed, Kendall and her family won't be there to see it. Pat Duggins, APR News, in Marion.
All year long, the Alabama Public Radio News Team has been investigating rural health care in the state. Studies often list Alabama as having the worst infant mortality rate in the nation. One factor is the lack of maternity units in rural hospitals in Alabama. This can lead to premature births or delayed care, which are often blamed for early infant death. APR's Pat Duggins has more on one hospital business model that could help, but possible changes to the Affordable Care Act might make matters worse.
It's hard for us to support each other because we're kind of just surviving.
We met Kendall Gilchrist during our story on getting smaller hospitals in rural communities. We spoke to Kendall and her husband Eric at their home in Perry County. That's one of seven rural counties in Alabama with no hospital. Eric summed up their situation this way.
My son falls out of bed in the middle of the night. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. And he wakes me up and he has blood rushing down his face and he had gashed the corner of his eye open and there's blood, you know, all over his face. It's 2 o'clock in the morning in rural Alabama. What do you do?
The Gilchrists prefer the medical specialist they can get in Birmingham. That's a 3-hour round trip from Perry County. Their son was okay, but the story doesn't end there. The Gilchrists have 3 children. Kendall recalls the pregnancy that might have made it 4.
Early on, I got sick, and I thought it was just a stomach bug. I'm playing, you know, phone tag with this practice that I barely know, 90 miles away, talking to on-call physicians, trying to weigh, is it worth driving 180 miles round trip just to be told that I have a stomach bug? I end up choosing not to go in. And then about 5 weeks later, when I go to my monthly appointment, I find out the baby had died.
Labor's not fun anyway, but being jolted around in the back of an ambulance on rural roads is worse.
If there's anyone who can sympathize with Kendall Gilchrist, it's Ashley King. She's had her own problems with rural health care and childbirth. King lives in Hale County, southwest of Birmingham. And how many hours in an ambulance are we talking about?
It was two and a half. Two and a half to three. While I was in labor.
Hi, cutie pie.
More on King's story in just a moment.
Okay. So how's he doing with feeding?
This four-month-old is getting a checkup at University Medical Center in Tuscaloosa. The hospital in west central Alabama attracts pregnant women from rural communities up to 90 miles away. That's roughly 24 counties.
Well, the average patient either does not hold a job or works in fast food restaurant, gas station.
Dr. Catherine Skinner directs the obstetrical unit at the center. She says many of her patients from rural Alabama tell a similar story when the baby comes.
They will need transportation, so they'll have to get their friend to drive them. That friend will probably miss work the next day and therefore miss their income. They need gas money to get here, and childcare if they have other children.
That's one out of every five pregnancies Dr. Skinner sees every day. The reason University Medical Center is so popular with rural families comes down to the numbers. Alabama has 54 rural counties. Seven of these counties have no hospital at all. Of those that are left, only a fraction deliver babies.
Today, only 16.
That's Dale Quinney. He's executive director of the Alabama Rural Health Association. Quinney says it often boils down to the cost.
You have to have the specially trained staff. And, of course, your specially trained family medicine physicians or OBGYNs. You have to have the labs, the incubators, special equipment. Those cost money. And you have to have that whether you have 10 births or 1,000.
And the financial burden isn't only because of staff and equipment.
With obstetrics, there are, you know, huge liabilities you can get into as well.
That's Joseph Marchant. He's CEO of Bibb Medical Center in the rural town of Centerville, south of Birmingham. We also met him during our story about smaller hospitals for rural communities in Alabama. Marchant's hospital stopped delivering babies in the year 2000.
There's a lot of risk, and when you have risk, that certainly means that there could be substantial costs or problems if you have a bad outcome.
And to hear Ashley King tell it, her case could have fallen into that category. King first became pregnant when she was just 16 years old. Then roughly 12 weeks before she was due, this happened.
I started having chest pain, labor pains, migraines. I was blacking out, driving down the road in Dallas County.
Dallas County is about an hour east of where King lives. Just heading home wasn't an option because Hale County only has one small clinic.
They can do stitches and broken bones. Other than that, everything else goes to Tuscaloosa or Birmingham.
King and her unborn baby needed specialized care at UAB Hospital in Birmingham. That's 2.5 to 3 hours away.
I remember bits and pieces of that ambulance ride in the I remember first getting in the ambulance, and I remember how bad it hurt to be jolted around. In full-blown labor, it's not fun.
Good. So we just walked in the front of the hospital, and we're going to go to the med-surg unit and see.
And King isn't alone. Women in Bibb County face similar challenges finding obstetrical help when Bibb Medical Center stopped delivering babies in the year 2000.
And, of course, this is the main nurses' station in the hospital.
Joseph Marchant was in grade school when that decision was made. When he took the job of CEO at Bibb, he felt something was missing.
We have people that, you know, were delivered here in the 1960s and 70s that come back and we'll talk about, wow, how the campus has changed.
2 years ago, that led Marchant to pose a question to the hospital's board and its staff members.
What would reopening obstetrics mean to the other parts of the system?
In 2015, after juggling the budget at Bibb Medical Center, they did.
You know, people drive up and they're ready to have a baby. So we have to make sure that we have a good, efficient process to get them through the system and get them admitted. And
the newly reopened maternity unit has four delivery rooms and a small waiting room. Bibb celebrated its 100th birth since delivery started again in 2015, and financially it's breaking even. But all may not be well. How the system works could be its greatest weakness. Marchant says the doctors who handle births at the hospital don't technically work for him.
They actually operate a medical practice here in Centerville, and they are an independent group that actually work out of a federally qualified health center.
That health center is paid for by a grant through the Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare. And all the talk in Congress about repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act has Marcia wondering how long the unit can stay open.
We look at what's working, we look at what's not working, we try to affect the things that don't work positively, and we try to enhance the things that do work, and it seems that in Congress sometimes that's not the way they do things.
Back at University Medical Center, a rural mother-to-be is getting a checkup after a 45-minute car trip, or more specifically, her grandfather drove her and her husband to the appointment. If Bibb County loses federal funding and its labor and delivery unit closes, it could mean more than just extra work for the doctors in Tuscaloosa.
We know that when labor and delivery units close, the infant mortality rate in that county rises.
For Dr. Catherine Skinner, that could lead to more examples of what she calls her nightmare patient scenario.
She knew she was having contractions. She knew it was time. And she arrived too late to be able to stop labor. And the baby was born very prematurely. Hadn't had lots of medical issues because of it.
And studies indicate Alabama already has one of the highest infant mortality rates in the nation. Pat Duggins, APR News, in Tuscaloosa. All year long at Alabama Public Radio, we've been looking at rural health. Issues with rural health in Alabama sound recent, but they're not. 2017 was the 45th anniversary of an Associated Press story on how the public health system worked against Alabamians based on their race. APR Stan Ingold reports it also marked 20 years since the White House apology for the scandal.
You remember the Rodney King affair, right? The police beat the shit out of the guy. The Tuskegee story is the Rodney King story of medicine.
Meet Peter Buxton. He's known as the whistleblower on the Tuskegee study of untreated syphilis on the Negro male. In popular culture, it's also called the Tuskegee syphilis experiment.
Good morning. We give honor to Almighty God.
Buxton was the guest of honor at a ceremony at the Tuskegee History Center. It marked the 20th anniversary of the official White House apology for the syphilis experiment. The audience in Tuskegee included family members of the men involved in the study. They were all helped when Buxton and the Associated Press broke the story in 1972. He says back then, the turning point was a lunchroom chat with a co-worker at the U.S. Public Health Service.
I'll never forget what he was saying. He said the patient was insane, in desperate need of some kind of help. The family didn't know what to do.
This led Buxton to dig deeper, and what he found was a medical conspiracy.
There's this study being run down in this place called Tuskegee, and everybody in the study is black.
Buxton uncovered a program at the Public Health Service of finding African-American men from rural Alabama who had syphilis. Instead of treating these patients, the disease was allowed to progress while researchers took notes. It had been going on for 40 years, since 1932. Buxton recalls one doctor in the Tuskegee area who got into trouble for trying to treat one of the subjects with antibiotics.
The doctor who did the right thing had the medical society and the county health authorities jump down his throat. Look what you've done. You've treated one of these guys. You're not supposed to treat them. If he had had, let's say, pneumonia, there would have been a procedure to go through some paperwork to get permission to save the guy's life, for Christ's sake.
In 1972, Buxton tipped off a reporter from the Associated Press, and the story soon broke.
The men started out wanting just for me to settle their lawsuit and get an apology.
That's attorney Fred Gray. Before Tuskegee, his client list included civil rights icon Rosa Parks.
And they wanted a permanent memorial here.
What was done cannot be undone, but we can end the silence.
Gray sued, the government settled, and in 1997, President Clinton gave the subjects of the Tuskegee syphilis study the words they wanted to hear.
What the United States government did was shameful, and I am sorry.
This is actually a copy of my great-granddaughter's death certificate.
That's Lloyd Clements. He attended a gathering over the summer to remember the 20th anniversary of President Clinton's apology.
And they actually indicate that he actually died from syphilis.
Clemens is from Tuskegee, and several of his family members were a part of the study.
Initially, there was a lot of hurt and anger involved, knowing that my family was involved in it. Then the initial hurt turned to grief and sadness, and finally wound up turning to forgiveness on my part for my family.
People in Macon County, particularly African Americans, were vulnerable.
Dr. Reuben Warren is a professor of bioethics and the director of the National Center for Bioethics and Research in Healthcare at Tuskegee University.
Not that they were uneducated, but they were undereducated. Not that they were poor, because many of the men were not, but many of them were low income.
Warren says those running the study used trusted institutions like Tuskegee University and area churches.
And what young public health students are taught and researchers are taught, if you want to get populations for your research, particularly African Americans or Hispanics, where do you go? Go to the church.
Because of the public health services treatment of those involved in the syphilis study, massive changes were made to the way information is gathered. Participants must be informed that they are part of a study. They must be made aware of how the information will be used and what the possible effects of the study could be. However, I asked Dr. Warren if something like the syphilis study could happen today.
Absolutely. I think there are instances of bioethics and public health ethics violations as we speak that are occurring. So you've got to think about the whole effort of ethics, particularly around ethics around health. It's the difference between informed consent and consent. Are people truly informed when they're consenting?
Warren says the study done at Tuskegee still has an impact on minorities to this day.
Clinical trials are critical, but the proportion of African Americans, other people of color in clinical trials is terribly poor. And so if we're not engaged in the clinical trials, then the results of the clinical trials may not be applicable to those populations.
The changes brought on because of the Tuskegee syphilis study are supposed to protect the public. However, in rural Alabama, the memory of the study is still there, and the lingering distrust is clearly visible. For APR News, I'm Stan Ingold in Tuskegee.
Advocates of rural health in Alabama say one of the biggest issues is access to health care in rural areas. The state is facing a massive shortage of physicians, and the doctors we do have are largely concentrated in larger cities. APR's Alex Aubuchon reports on how doctors are starting to use technology to bring that care into rural Alabama.
So how is everything today?
It's good.
Yeah?
Everything's going good.
Mary Epp is 84 years old and a home dialysis patient. She's at a routine follow-up appointment with her endocrinologist, Dr. Eric Wallace, at the University of Alabama at Birmingham School of Medicine. But Mrs. Epp isn't in Birmingham. She's at the Dallas County Health Department, 75 miles to the south.
They can not only see each other face-to-face, but they can use enhancements to listen to the heart rate, to monitor the EKG, to look in the ears and the eyes, the nose, the throat.
That's Dr. Walter Geary. He's medical director for the Alabama Department of Public Health. Thanks to telemedicine equipment at dozens of county health departments across the state, Dr. Wallace is able to provide Mrs. Epp and many other patients a full-fledged checkup hundreds of miles apart. I caught up with Dr. Wallace at a statewide conference on telehealth.
Probably 80% of what physicians need to do can be done by listening to the patient. But we also need a physical exam. So what happens is I use a telestethoscope to listen to the patient's heart and lungs and abdomen. I use specialized cameras to look at lesions in dialysis patients, the exit site.
Dr. Wallace says providing care remotely is more than a convenience for these patients. He says it's quickly becoming a necessity given the state of healthcare in Alabama.
If we had 500 doctors to land in Alabama today, we still wouldn't have enough.
Ron Sparks is a rural healthcare and telehealth advocate.
If we had 250 dentists to land in Alabama today, we wouldn't have enough. So access to healthcare is definitely a problem in the state of Alabama. Using technology and using telemedicine is a way to reach folks who don't have access to healthcare.
Sparks previously headed the state's Office of Rural Development under Governor Bentley. He says the expansion of telemedicine is inevitable.
You've either used telemedicine or you will use telemedicine. That's sort of the way it is. It's going to happen.
Currently, there are several different small regional telehealth networks offering different services. Dr. Wallace says he wants to see all those providers working together.
My real vision for Alabama is that you have one overriding way of linking all of those networks together to create really a comprehensive network that is far-reaching and able to link any provider with any patient across the state.
The Alabama Department of Public Health is taking the lead on developing that network. Jessica Hardy is the director of the Office of Women's Health at ADPH.
We have a very new telehealth program with the Department of Public Health. So we are growing, and we are being charged to try to go into 11 different areas of subspecialty at this time.
Public Health Medical Director Dr. Walter Geary says the possibilities are nearly endless.
That could be done for just the entire state of Alabama, if we had the bandwidth to do that, for a huge variety of problems and complications, all kinds of chronic illnesses, from diabetes to Crohn's disease to ulcerative colitis to diabetic ulcers of the feet. All of those kinds of things require daily treatment and management, but intermittent physician oversight.
Bandwidth is one potential hurdle to a widespread adoption of telehealth. Many rural areas in the state don't have consistent cell service, much less broadband internet, and supporting the high-resolution video conferencing along with medical readings in a telehealth visit requires a lot of bandwidth. Ron Sparks says it's hard to understate the importance.
You really live in rural Alabama in today's world, and you don't have access to broadband. That's like cutting off one of your main arteries to your heart. You're just not going to function very well.
But the Alabama Department of Public Health has an unusual leg up. Thanks to a state mandate, county health departments have special broadband infrastructure, and 60 of Alabama's 66 counties currently have the bandwidth for telehealth, even if other areas of those counties don't. Another model is gaining lots of steam across the border in Georgia, telemedicine systems in school.
Child's there at school all the time. That school nurse probably knows that child pretty well.
Sherry Williams works with the Global Partnership for Telehealth based in Georgia.
What if she is able to take that child to the next level by providing these care services into the mix? So it really becomes a whole lot bigger than just that primary care model. It truly can create a system of care.
Williams says school-based telehealth can fill major gaps in community health care, especially after rural clinics or hospitals in those areas close.
When a hospital closes, usually those primary care doctors leave also. So you're left with a huge void, not only for the children, but we're talking about entire populations at this point in time. So I think being able to put telehealth inside the schools is a huge step in the right direction in figuring out how to fill that health disparity in our rural communities.
Unfortunately, the model in Georgia isn't possible in Alabama, at least not yet, because of Medicaid regulations. State Medicaid rules don't consider schools an acceptable place to receive health care. And that's not the only way Medicaid regulations are posing a big problem to telehealth. Alabama doesn't have what's called a parity law in place. That assures doctors get paid the same rate whether they see a patient in person or remotely. Georgia does, as well as Mississippi.
Their telehealth program has been going on 15, 16 years now.
Michael Smith is the director of telehealth for the Alabama Department of Public Health.
They have about 6,000 telehealth encounters each and every month. We can benefit from the successes that they've made, but still have a lot of work to do in terms of development of our program.
Alabama is starting on the back foot in terms of telemedicine, but Dr. Wallace is optimistic about the near future.
What I foresee by being all the progress that we made thus far in the state, I foresee that at this time next year, you will have multiple subspecialties already at UAB providing care across the state. Important care that we need to actually improve the outcomes of patients in our state.
And so your next visit, when you come back on next month...
And that means patients like Mary Epp, dealing with a variety of complicated medical issues, can get quality health care a lot closer to home. I'm Alex Aubuchon, Alabama Public Radio News.
Oh, they're good. Let's see if you can see.
Oh, yeah.